Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to Good Job, where we interview inspiring people from the music industry. We follow their journey from their very worst job to present day and find out what makes them them. That roar was from comedian Mae Martin. Now, Mae is absolutely prolific with accolades across comedy genres, TV, improv, radio, a book, and musical comedy.
The worst thing you can do with addicts is what we do to them, which is put them in jail and punish them. And the best thing you can do is pull them closer and surround them with people.
We chat about why honesty is important in comedy, her battle with addiction, how society perceives sex and gender, and what it was like to film her new hit TV show, Feel Good.
So, we start the podcast the same way for everyone. What was your very worst job in life?
Okay, I'm going to go with, I worked the night shift at Amato's Pizza Place in Toronto. And so it was 6 p.m. until 4 a.m. And it was very hot. It was full of cockroaches and mice. And the people would come in after bars got out, wasted. And it was pretty hellish. And I had to take the hot pizzas out of the oven and I'd get burned. And then I had to take the garbage into the garbage room. And for some reason, there was no light bulb in there. And so you'd go in and it was pitch black and you could hear all the mice scurrying out of the way and you'd have to throw the rubbish in the bin. And then I'd get off at 4 a.m. and it would be getting light out. Yeah, that was bleak.
It sounds like a horror movie.
Yeah.
How old were you when you did this?
16.
Okay. Did you have plans? Because you were already doing comedy by then, actually, weren't you?
Yeah, I was kicked out of my house and I was sleeping on the sofa of a much older comedian, and I was sort of doing comedy, but I'd kind of stopped for a while.
Could you have imagined your whole life journey to where you are now?
Yeah, I think that was probably the only thing keeping me going, was this deep secret belief that I could do something one day. You know what I mean? So I never quite, although I had so much doubt about that, I think I must have on some level had at least some hope that kept me going, you know?
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning of your journey into comedy. How did it start?
To go really back, I think Ace Ventura came out and it changed my life. I think I was obsessed with Jim Carrey when I was about 8 or 9. But then my family took me to a stand-up comedy club when I was about 11, and the comedian got me up on stage and he made me sit on his lap and be like a ventriloquist dummy because I was this weird little 11-year-old in a waistcoat. And I was obsessed with it and I thought it was the coolest environment and that these people were, you know, gods. And then I just became obsessed with it. I took an improv class and then I started performing when I was 13, doing stand-up and sketch comedy. And then I never did anything else, really.
And you did a bit of musical comedy. Tell us a bit about that and why you did musical comedy and why also you don't really do that anymore, do you?
Yeah, I don't do it anymore. I mean, maybe I secretly always wanted to be a musician. I think a lot of comedians do. And then I would write these, parody songs, often like changing the lyrics to existing songs. And I loved doing that for a long time. But then now, what happened was the banter between the songs just got longer and longer until it was mostly banter. And then I think it was sort of a crutch, the guitar. And when I got brave enough to kind of put it down and just be myself and chat, things started going much better.
Do you think it's harder to, I guess, make it as a musical comedian? I guess it's not as easy to do, like you can't do like a chat show just with a guitar.
Yeah, there's a handful of people doing it who are really good at it. But I think I was just better at stand up and I think it was kind of just a way to delay having to be super myself and honest.
I mean, stand-up's terrifying. It's like the most terrifying idea to me. And as someone who is a singer, singing is like, ah, cool, I know how to do this. To just talk, I'm like, ah, no.
I find the reverse. So the idea of what you do, being kind of earnest and expressing your emotions through song without irony, that is terrifying to me. That's so vulnerable. And at least with stand-up, I feel very in control. And maybe just because I've been doing it a long time, I feel in my element.
Do you think that feeling comfortable in stand-up and me feeling comfortable in singing is just something that we have learned? Or do you think that's just our natural states?
I think it's like everything, a combination of nature and nurture. Because if you grow up in a house where your parents really value music or comedy, and my parents are really funny and they love comedy, and so I was lucky. So that was definitely a huge part of it.
So your TV show Feel Good has come out fairly recently. It was really good. Really enjoyed it. But it's semi-autobiographical. And how was that? Well, one, why did you write something about your own life?
I think I'd pitched tons of ideas over the years, and a lot of them had been really big genre things, like science fiction things, and then ultimately, even with stand-up as well, I just slowly moved in a direction of being more specific and personal and honest. And then that seemed to be what people were responding to and actually connecting with more. Like, the more specific and personal I was and saying weird stuff that I thought no one would connect with, people were like, me too. So I think that I did a stand-up show called Dope that was about addiction and relationships. And then Channel 4 approached me about turning that into something. So then me and my co-writer Joe just kind of built a world around that. Yeah, and it was intense.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially putting that onto the screen and acting for the first time. How did you approach acting?
I cast amazing people around me. It was important to me that whoever was going to play George, my girlfriend, in it was someone that I really found funny and had like a natural chemistry with. And Charlotte was a friend of mine already, so that was helpful because we already had like a rapport and really find each other funny. So that was helpful. And then I just rehearsed a lot. We had about 3 weeks of rehearsing. We did a pilot actually that was really useful because it wasn't bad, but it was an opportunity to find the characters and for me to get a bit of practice. And then once the show was commissioned, that went in the bin. And I don't know, I kind of thought that acting was just about arranging your face in a certain way. Like, I'm sad, so I should make my face sad. So I was obsessed with my face. And then someone told me, oh, you just have to feel the feelings and then your face will naturally do what a normal person's face does when they, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think I had to sort of release ego a bit and vanity and just feel the feelings and trust that my face was doing the right thing.
I mean, going into that, a lot of the writing stems from like real life experiences. So how was that going into those places through acting again?
If I'd known how it would feel, I might have written it differently. So I'm kind of glad I didn't know that it would be quite intense. And so writing it, I was like, yeah, fine. Yeah, I'll snort some coke and do this. And yeah, doing it was weird. I the drug stuff was really depressing. But the pace was so fast and I had such fun people around me and supportive people. And I got on so well with everyone. I had Joe, my co-writer, is my best friend. And I had Charlotte being amazing and the director. So it was absolutely fine. I was so intensely focused on trying to make something good that I didn't have much time to kind of like spiral into a well of despair, you know?
You talk a lot about addiction within both your TV show and just your general stand-up. How much do you think other people who don't have a specific addiction, how much do you think this applies to other people?
I think the more you start thinking about it and reading about it, the more you'll notice it in your own life, maybe. I definitely think we have a kind of crazy phone problem. People really casually say like, oh, I'm addicted to my phone. It's like, no, I really like, I spend 2 hours on my phone before bed, lying in bed. I wake up and go on it. That's really crazy. Yeah, I think people feel it in varying degrees. Definitely, I think people can relate to the relationships thing, especially when you're young, of being in a relationship that you know is not good, and but you honestly think, if I'm not in this relationship, I'll die. And your whole self-worth is about that person. I think a lot of people have had that experience. And I think that's a sort of form of it, where you're chasing that high of how good it feels when you have that person's attention, you know?
We were chatting about this before, and I was thinking about all the things that, like, you could vaguely say, or I could vaguely say, that I'm addicted to. Anything from, like, coffee to work. I love work. And then where that all stems from. Coffee feels like such a physical, just, like, I want to get up in the morning and be awake. But something like work, for me, is definitely, like, I guess, an acceptance thing, or, like, I've grown up with such an idea that that's what makes you a good person if you're a hard worker.
Yeah.
Where do you think the general addictions stem from?
There's habits, and then there's addiction. I think somewhere I read that the definition of addiction is if it's having a negative impact on your life, but you keep doing it, you can't stop doing it. So, yeah. And where does it come from? I think different places. I think it's, again, like so many things, a combination of nature and nurture. There's so much to read about it, but it's about dopamine. Mm-hmm. If you have a dopamine deficiency in your brain, then when you do get a hit of dopamine from whatever it is, like a drink or a drug, or even the bright colors on your phone, then you have fewer dopamine receptors in your brain. So it feels a lot more overwhelmingly positive, and the withdrawal is a lot worse. So that is a chemical thing that some people have, and that can come from anything from early childhood to, you know, adolescent kind of experiences. You could get, like, in the wild, they do tests on animals. It can come from, like, prolonged isolation. You can get a dopamine deficiency, lots of things. I think the cure is human connection. I think that's staying busy and human connection.
I guess also that's what all of us crave at the end of the day. Like, that's our biggest addiction, if you want to be cheesy about it. But everyone wants that, if it's love.
Of course. Yeah, and it's the worst thing you can do with addicts is what we do to them, which is put them in jail and punish them. And the best thing you can do is, you know, pull them closer and surround them with people.
What do you hope that people take away from your TV show?
I hope that it humanizes addiction a little bit. I think people often think about addicts as this group of people that are, you know, junkies, and we can't really relate to them. But actually, addiction is an experience that a lot of people, I think, can relate to, not just substances, but that feeling of doing something compulsively, even though it's having a negative effect in your life. So relationships and TV and our phones, and everyone, I think, can relate to that. So I hope that it makes us think about addiction a bit differently. And then, yeah, I just hope people are entertained by it, you know.
I feel like it covers so many societal, I guess, issues and taboos that people think are taboos. But at the same time, it does feel kind of light. So it's you've struck a really good balance with that, which is entertaining.
Thanks. Yeah, I wanted it to be really accessible. And also, people are funny in their lives. You know, you can be in the middle of a breakup and someone says something funny and you both laugh for a second. Like, life is funny. So I didn't want to get bogged down in kind of heaviness. I wanted the tone to really be a comedy drama.
Do you think it's really important for entertainment to touch on wider issues?
There's nothing worse than something that is written for the purpose of getting a message across. It feels so heavy-handed and boring. And a lot of the stuff that I grew up loving is just pure silliness, you know. I love French and Saunders, and I remember when I was first coming to England, Mighty Boosh was huge, and there's so much space for that. And I just don't necessarily have that skill. My thing that I do is that I'm super personal. But also, I don't think the show would have worked if I was like, this is what I want to say about addiction or sexuality. It was more like, what are these characters feeling? And yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The quick fire round. Tea or coffee?
Tea. No, coffee.
Ah. Music or lyrics?
Music.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Creativity or logic?
Creativity.
Plane or train?
Plane.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
Sweet treats or savory snacks?
Savory snacks. Hundi pea.
City or countryside?
City.
Matching or odd socks?
Odd.
Guitar or piano?
Guitar.
Friday night in or Friday night out?
Out.
Modern or vintage?
Vintage.
Black and white or technicolor?
Black and white.
Moose or mouse?
Moose.
You have to say moose, don't you?
Yeah.
It would be a bit rude of you not to.
My parents claim that they once drove under a moose. And me and my brother think this cannot be true. And we've Googled the largest ever recorded moose and the size of their car at the time. And they swear that this happened. And then yesterday I saw a video of a huge moose. So maybe it's possible.
Hey, this is the part of the podcast where I give you a fun fact about our guests. May started comedy when she was only 13 years old. She then trained for 4 years in sketch comedy and improvisation at the Toronto outpost of the internationally acclaimed institution, The Second City. The Second City was formed in 1882 in Chicago, but then went on to have 3 touring companies and, of course, opening a theatre in Toronto. By the mid-1970s, both the Chicago and the Toronto venues became a source of cast members for Saturday Night Live, and it boasts quite a few notable alumni, including Mike Myers, Tina Fey, Steve Carell, to name a few.
So you also wrote a book, which is really cool. Can everyone please calm down? A Guide to 21st Century Sexuality. It's a big, long title. Why did you choose that title?
Just because I felt like it's... all the conversations about sexuality and gender right now in the media are so politicized and kind of explosive and stressful. And actually what we're talking about is love and sex, and that stuff is supposed to be fun. And I just was thinking about young kids. The book's aimed at teenagers, and I was thinking how stressful it would be if you were, you know, having feelings for someone you're in your teens, and then you turn on the news and people are having these insane debates about trans rights and stuff. So I just thought, let's take the attention away from the pedantic focus on labels and words, and let's just talk about the very human and universal experience of being attracted to different things. And, you know, it's not a book just for LGBT people. It's everybody has a sexuality, right? Straight people have very varied and complex things that they're attracted to, and it's just the same for everyone, I think.
Our listeners come from all around the world, all different genders, all different backgrounds and ages, and some of those listeners have a more traditional view on sexuality and gender and things like that. How would you explain your book to someone who has a more traditional view?
Well, it's funny the word traditional, because that kind of, I think we sometimes think that this new kind of fluidity around sexuality and gender and stuff is a recent thing, and it's a millennial kind of thing. But actually, if you look at human history, as far back as there's been human civilization, there's been variances in sexuality and gender. There's, you know, different cultures that recognize multiple genders or have bisexual gods and things. And it's actually quite a recent thing that we've had this very binary view of, you know, people are gay or straight, and that's maybe just a blip. And maybe we should get back to the more traditional view, which is that things are a little more fluid. But also if people are freaking out about it and they're listening to this being like, I hate you, I would say just don't stress. Nobody's trying to force you to do anything. Everybody just wants to have a nice time and be in love and fulfill their potential on the planet as a loving and happy human being.
Yeah, for sure. How much do you think in recent years the public perception on sexuality has changed?
I think it's always getting better, but then it can very quickly slip backwards as well. So I think it's important to be vigilant. And I think sometimes there's a perception, because of the disproportionate amount of media coverage it gets, that you know, that battle's been won and everybody should, you know, stop whining about it now. But just because we have gay marriage, it doesn't mean that there's not like certain intersections in the city where I'd be scared to go. You know, we have a kind of a long way to go. It's still illegal in so many countries, and the death penalty in lots of countries. So it's still kind of a pressing human rights crisis. So, you know, have a little patience for the visibility of it now and the ubiquitousness that you might perceive, because it's actually just the very upper crust, and underneath there's still a lot of progress to be made.
It's really interesting because as humans, I think we completely like box ourselves in all the time to anything, whether and it's like so tribal in how we are all the time with everything, even if it's music, being like, this is my favorite band and every other band's rubbish. and everyone's like that with everything. And I think we just need to like chill out about everything, literally everything. We can just be like, you know what, it doesn't matter. You do you, I do me, whatever.
I think you're right. It's people want to be part of a tribe and they want to feel safe in there. But, and I even see that in the gay community a lot, like a lot of bi phobia. Like I'm bi or whatever, if I had to put a label on it. Like I date men and women, and I've been booed off stage at pride festivals. Not booed off stage, but been booed for talking about dating boys by people who think because I have short hair I should be gay. Like, you know what I mean? Everyone needs to chill.
Yeah. I think that's like a lesson for life. Just chill out.
Chill.
For sure. Do you ever doubt your direction or yourself with your comedy?
Yeah, all the time. Totally. Yeah, I worry that I'm going to wake up one day and have nothing more to say or not be able to write anything new. But I think now it's become enough of a muscle that is pretty active. So I think it's okay. I mean, definitely with stand-up, I now, for the first time, maybe it's taken like 20 years to get to this point, but I feel like confident that if I can go on stage and be at home there, you know?
You do quite a lot of improv-y type things as well.
Yeah,
you stand up.
Exactly.
So you must feel like...
That's a good feeling. I love improvising and talking to the audience and stuff. And then, so then you feel like if you've got that muscle honed, and it's so fun. It's so fun. I've loved doing that. That's only been the past few years, doing an hour of improvised stand-up based on audience questions. And that's maybe the most fun I've had on stage.
So interesting to me. That sounds the most terrifying. It's nice to have that element of control. Actually, weirdly though, going back to music, if I get to improvise a song and someone's just playing and I get to sing along, I'm like, oh, this is great fun. So I guess I kind of get that.
There you go.
Side.
Yeah, it taps into some level of instinct or intuition, and it's fun and makes you present.
Well, that's a good thing always. If you could wake up tomorrow having gained one quality or ability, literally anything in the world, what would it be?
I dwell on the past a lot, or I worry about the future, and I would love to have like a switch that I can, it's voluntary. Like I only have to switch it when I want to switch it, but it just blocks out the past and the future. So I'm just in the present moment. Mm-hmm. That would be amazing, because you could always switch it off and have a nice wallow in the past or process stuff and worry about, but to be able to be like, I'm going to this dinner party or something, or I'm going to this thing and I just want to be present. Yeah, mm-hmm. That would be amazing.
Yeah. So do you feel like you're successful in what you've done?
No. Well, I feel really proud of Feel Good. And I'm pretty self-critical, and I'm proud to have done it, and so grateful. But in general in life, there's so much further I want to go. But then also on a personal level, like I've been Zooming a lot of my friends, and so, you know, a lot of my friends have little babies and wives and husbands, and in that area I'm very bereft at the moment. I think I'm feeling that in lockdown anyway. I'm sure a lot of people are, where I'm like, yeah, cool, I'm getting these Instagram followers, but where's my toddler that loves only me, you know?
Is that when you'll feel like you're successful?
I think so. I think probably. But then they say you're not supposed to obsess over it or focus on it, because like it's when you stop worrying about it then it comes. Also, I've made a choice like years ago to really pour myself into work. So I'm sure I, you know, had blinders on.
But then a lot of people from the outside will be like, this is like super successful person.
Yeah, totally. And I'm very grateful and lucky. Yeah. And the past couple of years have been insane.
It's so interesting because we just all have our own, I feel like we move our own goalposts. We kind of all the time, constantly. And we're like, oh, that I'll be happy and I'll be successful at this point. And then even if you get that thing, you're like, I'm not successful. I need to get that thing.
100%. Yeah. And I think I definitely thought for my whole life, oh, if I get this one thing, then I now know for sure that career success is not necessarily connected to happiness, right? It's it feels good, but it's it's about the work you're doing outside of that makes you happy.
It's something that I've definitely found in my life, because as a hard worker person, it just, you can put everything into your work and then you get to a point and you're like, this does not, I don't know, I'm not any happier than I was before. Yeah, I seem to have, as I say, like more followers on my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And that is what I thought would bring me happiness. And it's been something throughout the last couple of years where some of the things that I've wanted have happened that I've been like, oh, I don't know, it doesn't make sense to my brain to begin with, but now I'm starting to be like, right, like meditation, that's making me more happy than what the things that I originally thought would make me happy. So what has been your biggest challenge in your career or your life?
Getting off hard drugs was really, really hard. That was hard. I'm glad to have done that. And then a sort of similar feeling is a relationship or two where there have been moments in my life where I've thought I will never be out of this situation. I'll never feel okay without, or like, and you know, unless I figure this out, I'll never be okay. Like really given up my whole identity to drugs or really bad relationships. And I think I'm at a place now where I wouldn't let that happen again, ever. So I think that's been the biggest challenge, because I think that's partly about just chasing the intensity of emotion, which can feel exciting, and I think I've moved past that. So yeah.
What is, with your comedy, your ultimate direction? Where do you want to go? You've done so many different things with your work.
I'd love to do more feel good, and I'd love to do, I have a couple other secret things in development. I'd love to do a movie. I would like to, because I'd never acted and now I have. I've really enjoyed that. So I kind of want to play a superhero.
A superhero.
I don't know. I want to play like bat person, you know, and I could get really into it, I think. I don't know. Maybe I'm being crazy, but I wouldn't mind playing a character that's very separate to myself and very different. I think that would be really refreshing.
What would be your superpower?
I mean, I literally want to be Batman. So just
having like a wicked voice,
having a wicked voice and a lot of gadgets.
Yeah. So you have had quite a cool journey. Do you think do you believe in fate? Do you think fate is a thing? Or do you think it's just the way it's happened and your hard work?
In terms of work, I think it would be naive not to acknowledge that, like, privilege basically is fate, like that I'm so lucky to have been born like middle class white, like I got a big head start and to have parents that valued education and, you know, pushed me, and I feel like that's a huge thing, privilege. And then on top of that, hard work is key. So yeah, I mean, in terms of like love and stuff, I try to believe in fate. But in terms of career, I think that's just like capitalism and privilege, isn't it?
Final one. Do you have any advice for people who want to enter the entertainment industry? What should they do?
I think the first thing is finding people to collaborate with who you are on the same wavelength as and who you really get on with. Like the people who I met early on and those relationships that I maintained are now the people that I'm working with. Like the director of our show is someone I met when I was 20, and I'm really glad that we kind of came up together. And yeah, collaboration I think is key. And then I think there's no real shortcut around just hard work as well, and putting the hours in and being super patient, because it takes a long time. There's so much rejection.
Mm-hmm.
You won't be as good as you want to be at first, and then eventually you will be.
I guess as well, being happy with not being as good as you want to be. That's the hardest thing that I've found.
Totally.
Especially when I was younger. I really, really struggled and was like, I can't do this thing. I am completely terrible. And then it's really hard to like continue after that point.
This is what the director of Feel Good was saying to me, that there's, when you start, there's such a huge gap between your taste and what you aspire to and your ability. So you start making a short film and you're like, I know what I like. I want this to be like Quentin Tarantino or something. And then you see the final product and you're like, this is shit. And then that's the point where you have to not give up, because the more you do, the smaller that gap will be between your taste and your ability.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Bar.
Thank you to May. If you want to check her out, go head over to maymartin.net. And you can also find her TV show, Feel Good, on Netflix. Don't forget to subscribe, rate and review on your podcast app of choice. It really helps us share these stories with more people. We love your feedback, so feel free to drop us an email at goodjob@bethroars.com. And if you'd like early access to the episode and just to support the podcast, head over to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/bethroars. Once again, massive thanks to May, to James and Kazra at One Fine Play for the initial edits, to my co-producer Tom, who works super hard on these episodes, and to you guys for listening. See you in the next one. Bye.
Good job.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.